Have you ever loved someone so much that you followed them around and talked endlessly about them to all your friends and family? That's how much we love rhododendron, a quirky and amazing genus of flowering plants with a deep human history and an incredible ecological legacy. Follow along on our adventures as we learn about the remarkable things that folks all around the world have done for the love of rhododendron. Episode 10, Expect Blooms Anytime. In this episode, we meet Dawn Graham, a retired emergency medicine doctor, a longtime member of the Portland chapter of the American Rhododendron Society, and a rhododendron gardener extraordinaire. We find out how he successfully transitioned his love of rhododendron from a large-scale outdoor rock garden to a small but mighty indoor garden, prominently featuring tropical epiphytic rhododendron species known as viraeas. Dawn shares techniques he's used to transform his second floor condominium and balcony into a botanical wonderland so spectacular that passersby are known to shout their praise from down below. And we learn that the best thing about growing a viraea garden in your house is that you can expect blooms anytime. Recalling the words of biographer and historian Jenny Uglow, we may think we are nurturing our garden, but of course, it's our garden that is really nurturing us.
Well, welcome to For the Love of Rhododendron. I'm Connor Ryan, one of your hosts today, alongside Christina Woodward. How are you doing, Christina?
Oh, I'm doing just fine and below zero temperatures, just to give our audience an inkling of where we are.
Yes, it's very cold here in Ohio too. And I'm really excited to talk to our guest, Dawn Graham, about viraea rhododendrons and growing rhododendrons inside, which would be a very welcome break from the bleak winter that we're both experiencing right now. Dawn is a longtime member of the Portland, Oregon chapter of the American Rhododendron Society and has quite extensive experience growing rhododendrons both indoors and outdoors. And we're very happy to have Dawn here. Welcome, Dawn.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's really great to have you, Dawn. And it's funny, we record these through Zoom, and Dawn has this spectacular viraea rhododendron right behind him, so we get to look at it the whole time we're talking. It's very fun. And I think we'll start with the hard-hitting questions first, and that's, how do you say this word? It's a word, viraea. I've seen it, viraea, viraea, viraea. Everyone says it differently. I don't know if there's a right way to say it, but we're going to call you our resident expert.
I don't profess myself to be an expert on the correct pronunciation of it, but E. White Smith certainly would categorize that, and he uses the phrase viraea.
Great. Well, I will try to stick with that. I'll do my best anyway. So we're here to talk about rhododendrons that you could potentially grow indoors, and especially the viraea rhododendrons. Can you talk about some of the viraeas a little at all? I know that they're a rhododendron. Beyond that, I don't know.
Okay, so I think that most people haven't even heard of what viraea rhododendrons are, but they're tropical rhododendrons, and they are, viraea is a subgenus of the genus Rhododendron. And there's 9 subgenuses in that category. And viraea is probably best known in the Southeast Asia area, primarily in Australia, but it's also grown well in New Zealand and the Southeast Asian islands. And it's does very well actually in Hawaii as well, but it's not native to Hawaii. So the species you find are Southeast Asia and Australia. There are some differentiations between hardy rhododendrons, which all categorizes all the others, and viraeas. And from a flower standpoint, there's no stalk in the truss or stem or rachis or whatever you want to call that structure. It all comes off of what looks like a little thimble or an umbra that are umbelled. And so each one of the flower stamens are almost identical in length, and they tend to form flat trusses rather than upright know, bulbous trusses like you see in the hardy rhododendrons. And the other differences too, the flowers themselves, I don't believe have any blue pigment at all. And there's no spotting in the flowers. And so they tend to be shades that are do not blend, that don't have blends of blue in them. And so it tends to look tropical, and what I always consider to be tropical, with oranges and reds and pinks and yellows, et cetera. As far as the growth habit locally in those areas where they're native, they tend to grow in areas where it isn't 100 degrees every day. You'd think of those areas to be super hot, but they're at elevations that aren't at those temperatures. And in my attempts to get these plants to do well, I've tried to mimic that entire environment. The only thing that I can't mimic perfectly is the humidity. I do get close. They like what I'm giving them right now, but I can't match 70 to 80% humidity all the time.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing that we call them the tropical rhododendrons, and I guess they do like grow in the tropics, but they are almost always growing on mountains in the tropics.
Right.
And so you get this like weird mix of like somewhat cold, probably not like below freezing cold, but somewhat cold, and then that high humidity, and it's still like low latitudes in the northern hemisphere anyway. It's very interesting.
Well, it helps to think of elevation in the tropics as the further you go up in elevation is like going north in latitude. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to go too far up in elevation to get dramatic changes in temperature.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing that you were talking about that I didn't realize, I've tried to grow a few viraeas, never long enough to see them flower. But I guess I've never really seen the flowers in person. So when you talk about them not really having like much of a stalk on the on the flower, I guess I never even thought about that.
Yeah. So when you look at the trusses, they tend to be more flat in appearance. And those flat trusses, it's pretty interesting how the flower and the stamen, everything falls off at once, and then leaves this thimble looking, I think it's called an umbel. That they come off of rather than a long axis that the standard rhododendrons have. It's kind of interesting because, you know, when you deadhead hardy rhododendrons, you want to take that entire complex off, but there's no taking that off with these. There's nothing to take off.
Yeah, and the other thing that you had mentioned is that they are a type of rhododendron and they're their own subgenus. I've also seen sometimes, as many people will learn as they get in more and more to rhododendron, is that it's just very, very complex. People trying to like make 1,000 species make sense. And so I've also seen that there's sometimes a section of rhododendron within the like lepidote group of rhododendrons. Is that right? That
they, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are, when you talk about different structure of all rhododendrons, they all have different leaf shapes. I mean, I have 8 specimens right now that I'm growing indoors that are doing very well, and they all have different morphology, completely different. Wow. And I'd have to say that in my past, when I've grown plants, I've tended to gravitate, not necessarily the ones that have the best flowers, but the ones that look the best year-round. Right. And that's, in my situation right now, that's exactly what I've had to do because I've been banished to a condominium.
Yeah, it's one of the funny things that I think about with our so I help run a rhododendron breeding program at Holden Arboretum, and among the other problems with rhododendron, like just keeping them alive, is that they're boring after they're done blooming. They're just green blobs, and especially places on the West Coast like you, where there's plenty of other evergreen things, just kind of blends in.
You know, I understand completely what you're talking about, but I've never felt that way. In fact, I've always sought to have at least a few varieties that are towering so that I could prune them up and look at their trunks all day and use them for a shade canopy to sit out in the shade. And so I appreciate that. And that's what I'm looking to do with, for instance, Easter Pastel that you can see blooming behind me. That plant will probably be 8 or 9 feet high, and it's going to be in my house.
That's so funny.
So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, if I could interject a question, one of the reasons that some people do collect rhododendrons or cultivate them and grow them is because of the leaves. There's such a variety of leaves in the rhododendron family.
Yes.
Do Thyreas have the same quality in their leaf structure?
Yes. And to give you an example, Rhododendron Lucy Sorensen is a Thyrea, and it has leaves that look very similar to a Carume azalea. And those flowers are tiny orange bells, and that plant has bloomed for me 5 times since I've had it for 2 years, at 5 different times, just months apart sometimes. And it's very attractive that way. It doesn't bush up like azaleas do, but the leaf structure is like that. And on the other hand, this plant you see blooming behind me has leaves that are almost indistinguishable from a hardy rhododendron. In fact, I think that Steve McCormick thought maybe it was a hardy rhododendron, but it's not.
Wow.
It's enjoyable. I agree with you about the plant habit and leaf shapes. There's a lot of appeal just to that, not just the flower.
Yeah, and I think I was reading that there's about 300 species, just naturally occurring species of Thyrea rhododendrons.
Yes. There are 300, and in my research into getting into the Thyrea section more, I did read a good passage on Thyrea.net about this particular topic you're discussing, and it really details pretty well, if I recall, all of the subgenuses. It mentions all of them and details why Thyrea is set out from the others.
Do you know if they tend to, so like within the like different groups of other types of rhododendrons, they tend to freely hybridize? Is that fairly true with the Thyreas?
I can't tell you if that has happened to the extent that non-Thyreas have. I don't know the answer to that, but it would seem logical.
Yeah, and I just like, so before we started meeting with Don sent over a bunch of really awesome literature about Thyreas, and one of them was this database of like Thyrea hybrid after Thyrea hybrid, and it just seemed like so many of these plants were just being crossed together from all kinds of different lineages.
That White Cloud database is tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so you mentioned that you have a Thyrea that blooms on and off throughout the year. Is that a common thing?
Yeah, and let me just back up a little bit about that. If I tried to mimic the environment that they grow in naturally, I'm giving them roughly 12 hours of sunlight, and I try to keep the temperature between 65 and 72. Sometimes it gets down to around 60, and I water them infrequently, just enough to, when they get dry, I water them. However, I've noticed that if I go more than a week, their leaves start dropping or folding. So I don't do that anymore. But in doing that, I get 3 growth spurts per year, and I get flowering at least twice a year, and Lucy Sorensen has bloomed 5 times in a year. So, and these are just young plants. So I'm thinking that as they get older, as with hardy rhododendrons, they'll be more prolific bloomers. And during the season, you know, the season tends to be fall, and E. White Smith tells me that I can expect blooms anytime now, which I have. There's a plant called Maureen Davidson, which is just getting done blooming for about 5 weeks. And Easter Pastel bloomed for 6 to 8 weeks. And they don't come out much like hardy rhododendrons do, where they all the flowers come out at one time. They come out slowly each. So it prolongs the bloom, and it's very attractive.
Wow, I can't even imagine. That sounds really cool. So you've got like that staggered blooming. And then do you see, you know, a common problem with rhododendrons outside is they get a petal blight. Do you see that indoors?
I haven't. But, you know, I'm in the process of deciding what the right thing to do or the correct thing to do in raising is. I redid my homework on it. And it's difficult to garner knowledge from individuals that are in the productive phase of their life because they're too darn busy to take impromptu phone calls. But White Smith is retired, and I probably could call him any time of the day that he's not sleeping, and he'd be glad to talk to me about it. So I'm not sure. He was the one that did the Thyrea vine for years from the Rhododendron Species Foundation. And eventually he and Lucy Sorensen set up the Varieté business at Bovey's, which I think for the longest time was maybe the only retail outlet for Varieté in the mainland until they both got quite old and retired. So now I think if it's in the U.S., you're talking about Hawaii. And Van Veen is making a great effort to get off the ground with that. Lucy Sorensen donated her stock to Van Veen, which they use for their cuttings for all what they have growing right now. And it's actually amazing how much they have growing. I picked up 3 plants from them, and I don't expect them to bloom for a while, but they're growing very well.
That is a real boost to, can I say, the rhododendron industry, because it introduces something new on a large scale, really.
Yes. Yes. And you know, it's a bit like trying to pound a square peg into a round hole, growing those. But if you're willing to go the extra mile, you know, it's pretty easy. You know, you seriously can put them outside as long as you don't cook them in the summer and bring them back in before it freezes. And they'll do well. They may not bloom as often as they would if you kept them in a stable environment. But they'll do that. And that's not an arduous thing to do. Almost everybody could do that. You just have to provide the proper setting indoors when you do bring them in. But I'm absolutely convinced that what I'm doing right now is tremendous, because they're actually growing like weeds and flowering, and it's just fabulous.
So besides your condo and maybe Van Veen Nursery and Hawaii, is there anywhere in the U.S. we can go see these?
You know, I've tried to find that. There is a nursery in Florida that has a brief section on Varieté in their on their website. And so I called them up and they said, no, we haven't had those for a long time. So I think that the only outlet right now is Hawaii and Van Veen.
Yeah. And then I guess the Rhododendron Species Botanical Garden has a bit in there.
Yes.
Their conservatory, right? Yep. That you'd expect them to have it.
Yeah.
And of course, there wouldn't be any locations in Canada.
Say that again.
Have a greenhouse for
there
sure.
There wouldn't be any locations in Canada.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Maybe, you know, somewhere in UBC or in BC. I don't know. I'm trying to convince, half-heartedly trying to convince people at work to put them in some of our greenhouses. We have a big, big greenhouse. I think it's something like 18,000 square feet in the middle of Cleveland. And it seems like a great place to fill with Varieté. But I just have to get some more support from my colleagues.
Yeah. Well, when Lucy Sorensen and White Smith were growing, I went through their greenhouse and it was spectacular. It was a large greenhouse. It was like a jungle of Varieté in there, and blooming intermittently in various parts of the greenhouse. It was just tremendous. And all of that went over to Van Veen.
Well, it's great that someone's carrying that on.
Yeah.
For sure.
So Don, we're really very excited about hearing about these rhododendrons, Varieté. And I hope that many people listening to us will also take an interest in pursuing some of the sources that we'll be posting onto the podcast page on the AARS site. But we also want to know something about the person who's growing these plants. And so I'm interested to know how you became interested in plants themselves.
Okay. Well,
where does that go?
In the late Crunchier, Minnesota, my grandmother recruited me to help her with her garden, which, you know, as 13 years old, was not at the top of your list when you could be out water skiing. However, I actually found it quite fun. And she taught me a lot about soil. And one of the things was harvesting leaf mold out of the forest, which I discovered makes your garden grow quite well. So, I mean, that's how I got my start. And other than just domestic flower gardening with my grandmother and vegetable gardening, after I got into college, I didn't get involved at all because I was too busy with that. And then North Dakota, you know, has such a short growing season. I think it's way shorter than even Ohio or Toronto, you know. So it wasn't until I finished medical school, we moved to Portland, and we discovered that it's like, hey, there's no winter here. And it didn't snow the first year. It was delightful. Leaf scarlet was blooming in February. And I got really attached to that. And instead of going back after finished training to the Midwest in the United States, we stayed. And it was shortly after that that I met Lucy Sorensen and George Watson, who are the proprietors at Bovee's Nursery in Portland. And she very quickly was and easily was able to get me involved in planting some interesting plants and taught me the right culture and plants that would be good in the setting that I had. And shortly after that first property with two kids, we moved out to a suburban location in Portland with an acre and a quarter, which I put 175 hardy rhododendrons, over 200 azaleas, a handful of giant sequoias and noble firs, and created a really nice garden. And we lived there for 18 years. And I would say that that's the location that got me most into the plants, because I had a very diverse selection of hybrids and BC plants there. Most of those plants were actually got from a gentleman whose name was George Clark. And he's an older gentleman that eventually lost his nursery to a freeway system in Portland. But he was spectacular about teaching me about plant habit and which ones to expect to give room to and which ones would be too leggy that I might not like, you know, which would be best the background and foreground plants, etc. So in time, you could show me a leaf and I could tell you what plant it was. And it was really a lot of fun. I really had a lot of fun doing that. And I made sure that I had plants that started blooming in February and stopped blooming in July. And we had very little other than a flower garden. We had very other little blooming shrubbery. Then I had got sent to Virginia for 5 years. And that was very difficult because the deer marauded that whole area and just munched on everything, including boxwood, which they're not supposed to do. So even if I had azaleas up near the house, they'd eat them. And the only plant that they would not eat was bravii. I have no idea why.
Interesting.
They ate the yaks, but they did not eat that.
Interesting.
And so that was the only plant that made it any size. When we sold the house, eventually moved back here, that was the only plant they had. But they ate the rhododendron atlanticum, and just it was very exasperating.
Could it be the indumentum on the leaves?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Didn't like it?
Well, it's like bravii has, it's like a different indumentum. I wonder if it's like, I don't know. Like
it's strange. It might be too spicy or something.
Yeah, it just feels weird on your tongue.
Yeah. And then I'm moving back. I was able to reestablish myself in a really wonderful setting and had probably close to 100 different plants. And one of them was a very large succulent that I bought as a stock plant that Bovee's was trying to get rid of. They'd actually dug it up and it was sitting on plywood on asphalt. And it was there for 2 or 3 months. And I said, my God, if that's on asphalt and it can live, that's the one I want. And it was spectacular. So that worked out well until I ended up having caught a virus from one of my patients and ended up having a brainstem injury from that virus. So that eliminated that ended my gardening outdoors. And I was sort of banished to a condominium. But we've got 50 feet of roof-covered deck.
Oh, that's your balcony.
Yes. And,
wow.
And we have about 35 feet of glass doors in 3 different rooms. So it's pretty bright in here, and I'm able to, I hand selected the plants to put on the deck in pots, and they've been there for 2 years and they're growing like crazy. So I've learned a lot about the culture of pot gardening and very careful not to overwater and not to miss watering.
Yes. Yeah, so that is a whole area of cultivation in itself, isn't it? The
yes.
Pot gardening.
Exactly. And that's the niche I'm in right now. We're on pot gardening, hardy rhododendrons outdoors, and Varroa pot gardening indoors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the differences I like about the Varroas is that they can take smaller pots. These big plants I have, like I have a loader right out of my deck that that pot must weigh 200 pounds.
Wow.
So they have to all be on dollies so I can move them around out of the sun when the sun's hitting them in the afternoon. So it's very easy. I'm not sure, but because of what it takes to, you know, make this work. I'm not sure that everybody would be happy about that unless they lived on a ground floor. We're up on the second level, and I can't let any runoff go down on the neighbor's furniture.
Yes, that would be disastrous.
Yeah, that, well,
unless you don't like the neighbors.
I can guarantee a knock on my door. So I don't upset people. So I collect all the water, and I have a fluid transfer pump, and I pump all the fluid out of the disc, keep the mosquitoes down.
Gosh.
It works great.
So you're a very diligent neighbor to take care of your my goodness. But, you know, this is also in a way path breaking, because one of my concerns is I no longer have a garden. I have this little patio patch, which, you know, really you can't grow too much on it. But I've been experimenting with a few rhododendrons, the Alpine Ferrugineum in pots. It's been in a pot. I've got several of them for, I think it's going on to its sixth year now. And they actually flower, you know, not greatly, but they do flower and survive.
Yeah. What's the coldest it gets?
Oh, well, minus 20 centigrade maybe would be sometimes more, but, you know, we wouldn't go much below that. And it's not that frequent.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was careful to pick varieties, hybrids, and species that would take a beating. The coldest it gets here is 14 Fahrenheit, and that's really unusual. Mm-hmm. And the hottest was 118 last summer. We had 3 days over 114. And there were three plants that took that sun and heat without any protection. And I couldn't believe it. One of them was PJM, Atlanticum, and Northern Lights Azalea. All three of them just breezed through that. And the next one closest to that was Lee Scarlet. That did really well too. But I had zero browning on PJM. And if anything, the heat made the aromatics out of that plant fantastic.
I didn't know it had an aroma.
Yeah, it has some sort of hydrocarbon that comes out of that that smells terrific just off the leaves.
Yeah, those lepidotes, the scaly-leaved ones, always tend to have a little bit of an aroma, but sometimes you have to crush it to really get it out. So it's funny that just heat would do it.
Yeah, you just rub your fingers on it.
And
you can,
perhaps in the confines of indoors, it will, you know, accelerate the scent.
Well, yes, and I do have a couple of plants that are necessary to have if I want to keep domestic tranquility. One of them is a winter Daphne, which started blooming December 23rd. And if I want it to keep blooming, if it freezes, I have to bring it indoors. And I usually leave it in for whatever period of time until I know the nighttime temperatures are going to be down. And that plant is about 4.5 feet high. And it fills the entire house with aroma when I do that. And it's easy to do when you have a dolly. You know, just drag it in and shut the door.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, these are really interesting experiments in a way that you're working on. But I find it very interesting that so many doctors, physicians have turned to horticulture as their pastime. And it's become more than a pastime for many. And also scientists, you know, not necessarily botanists, you know, they also turn to horticulture. I find that very interesting. Now, you were in, what was it, emergency medicine?
Right.
Many years?
Yes.
Well, what is the analogy here, you know, for?
I think that I got back into gardening because that's what I like. It wasn't a de novo thing. It's what I like to do. And it probably stems from my grandmother. Mm-hmm. That'd be my bet. You know, both of my grandmothers had sensational flower gardens. And I always found that interesting, you know.
Yes.
I didn't particularly like rototilling and things like that, but you know, planting potato hills and flowers, et cetera, was pretty cool. So I think that's how I got back into it. And the field of emergency medicine is pretty high stress. And having retired from active practice and doing a computer-based medical practice now is a lot more relaxing, but it's pretty boring. And looking out on the deck and I see my plants, it's really nice to go out there and sit with them any time of day.
It's wonderful that you can continue your hobby, your interest, and we benefit from it as well. So that's wonderful. I wanted to ask you, Don, when did you join the American Rhododendron Society?
When? It was in 1979 or 80, I believe.
Oh, so quite early on in your...
You're right. And I used to go to early meetings, and then my practice of emergency medicine got so hectic that I wasn't able to attend a lot of the meetings, and they didn't have Zoom meetings then. But I always read the journal. And then when we moved to Virginia, there was a big hiatus from it, because I was really kind of exasperated with gardening there. And then when I came back, my intent was to slow way down, which didn't happen until I retired 4 years ago. Now I'm back into it. But an event that got me out of the practice of medicine also has limited my physical capability. And I have to be doing things I know I can do. And house gardening is one of them. So that's pretty cool.
It really is. And we were wondering what, you know, you've done gardening in all kinds of different climates and geographical areas. Do you have favorite places? And we'd yes. like, what is your proudest achievement in horticulture?
Oh, actually, I think my proudest achievement right now is that I'm the only one that I know of that's got as many Vireas blooming in their bedroom. And I'm really happy about it. I mean, I wake up and I look over there and they're blooming. I said, man, this is amazing. I don't think I mentioned much about this yet. To get them to grow and do well means that they have to have timed light. And so I do have full spectrum lights, LED lights on them at the appropriate height and brightness. The lights I have five settings, and they're either on three or four, deep setting three or four, not on maximum. And they're timed for 12 hours. So you just set it and you don't have to do a thing with it. So other than buying it and setting it up, that's not very arduous. The watering part, what I've discovered is that you can keep them in small pots, and as long as you keep them hydrated correctly, but you can't just put water on them. And that's it, you know, because it doesn't soak into the material well enough. So I end up having to bring them out of the bedroom into the kitchen and water them in the kitchen sink and let water run through it until they're well watered, and then they drain until nothing comes out of the 12 holes I put in the bottom of each pot. And that usually takes an hour or two, and then I put them back, and that's good for a week. So there's some work involved with that part. As far as the fertilizing goes, yeah, when I talked to White Smith about that, he felt that just using a granular fertilizer once or twice a year was fine. I think that, you know, given the fact that I'm constantly leaching material out of the soil every time I'm watering, to me, it made more sense to use Osmocote light, full spectrum, you know, long acting or slow release fertilizer. And so far, I've been very happy with it. They don't appear to be over fertilized, and they don't appear to be under. I only have one plant that I can't figure out why this does this, but the leaves come out yellow, the new leaves, and then slowly turn to real intense deep green. And there's no veining of it. The whole leaf, including the veins, are like that. So I thought maybe it might be an iron issue, and I did put some chelated iron on all of the pots. That didn't make any difference. So that plant was Lucy Sorensen. And that's the one that flowers all the time. And it's also probably one of the ones that puts out more growth than any of the others. So I'm certain it's not a nitrogen issue. It's just something with that leaf, with that plant. Light, water, fertilizer. The pots are plastic, and I have them in as small a pot as I can get them in. And the minute they look like they need to have a bigger one, I'll do that. But, and plant material, I think that that's important. The Rhododendron Species Foundation has a plant material that they use that I think Van Veen is also using. And their plants appear to have the same thing. And it's a mixture of sphagnum moss, perlite, and a little bit of, I guess, potting soil. And then there's also some orchid bark in it. And Shirla Bertelman does orchid bark, perlite, and chunks of coconut. And I've got two plants that I repotted using shredded redwood that I got from the Singing Tree Gardens in California, Northern California. I mixed that with potting soil and perlite. And lava rock, by the way. That's the other thing I couldn't remember from the Species Foundation. They use pumice. So all of those drain tremendously well. And you put water on it, and it's like a second later it's going through. So that's I'm not unhappy with any of those three mixtures with my plants. They all seem to be doing well.
And do you make those yourself, or do you buy them?
No, I bought the material and I mix it.
Okay.
You know, I've got all that stuff, and, you know, my family thinks I'm nuts, but, you know, it's... I just can't imagine reinventing the wheel. If it works, you just use it, you know. Yeah.
So we've talked a bit about soil. We've talked a little bit about light. We talked about how you have a 50-foot long deck behind you where you're growing all your rhododendrons and your viraeas. Is that what you tend to do, is do you pull them in and out as needed? Is there a certain seasonality to it?
There's only two plants that I pull indoors from the deck. Okay. And one of them is winter Daphne.
Okay.
And I wouldn't do that if it wasn't blooming. And the other is Lee Scarlet, which is just starting to open now. There's one truss that's open on that plant, and I probably won't have to bring it in because I don't think we're going to see any freezing weather.
Wow.
We could, but.
So you live in a climate where you can grow everything outdoors year round, no problem.
Yeah. Other than varieties.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It's handy that way. So, and having everything on a dolly makes it super easy. I have a hook that I hook onto the dolly and drag it to wherever I want, and adjust in the summer when it's hot, I adjust the patio umbrellas to put the large leaf varieties underneath them. I mean, it just works great.
So do you have different sizes of dollies, or how does this
work? No, they're all the same, but you can adjust the size. You can expand them or contract them with the different screws that screw into the metal structure, and they hold 400 pounds each. And they have great wheels. The wheels are dual, and they're hard plastic polymer of some kind. And I mean, it just is perfect. And they roll around. I have rubber mats on the deck to keep from getting mildew and mold on the decking, on the deck material, and they roll around on that really easily. So it's actually a perfect setting. And if you inherited a garden like this, it wouldn't be a big thing. But if you had to start from scratch, the plants would just be one small factor. Getting everything set up just so does involve some work.
Yeah, it's one of it's one of the fun things about gardening, but also one of the most frustrating things about gardening is figuring everything out. It's never just straightforward.
Yeah, George Clark told me after I planted 175 rhododendrons, he said, "Are you all done?" I said, "Yeah, I can finally relax." And he said, "Silly boy." Boy, was he right. You know?
I'm wondering what are favorable companion plants to the collection that you have, for instance?
Right. So there's a gentleman that runs a nursery called Edelweiss Perennials. It's an online business only, but it's just south of town here a little ways. And I actually consulted him about that. And if you look at my plants out in these pots, they look pretty darn boring without anything in them, you know. And so I went to a rock vendor in town and bought some lava splatter rock pieces and placed that in the pots. And these are big, so the pieces don't have to be very big. And then I planted several companion plants to go with them. And my favorite is Anemone Nemorosa. And that comes in several different varieties or colors. But the one that I like the most is Royal Blue, which is kind of between blue and periwinkle. And it forms a pretty big clump. And it's a rhizome. So it spreads, you know, almost like stoloniferous rhododendrons do. And it produces cover to the summer with flower. And then when it's done, there's no pruning. It just shrivels up and blows away. And you don't even know it was there. And the first time I was exposed to that plant was a plant that I bought from Bovee's, a rhododendron that had some of those rhizomes in the root ball. And I didn't notice it. And so I planted this. And then about 2 years later, I noticed that the whole ground was covered with this stuff around 3 or 4 feet in diameter. It was perfect. You know, it looked great. And I thought, well, it's probably going to be a pain in the neck to clear it up. But I walked out one day and I hadn't paid attention to it, and it was all gone. It seriously just shrivels up and blows away. So that's a great companion plant. There are other plants. I have some dwarf Daphnes at the same place at a Weiss cell that bloom just like winter Daphne or Daphne Adora and smells just like it, only they bloom most of the summer continually. And those are tremendous. I don't put those in the smaller pots with rhododendrons, but they can be in the bigger pots. And they might get a foot to a foot and a half tall over several years, probably about 5 or 6 years. So those are great. And that was really kind of a surprise, because having a flowering plant like that, a perennial shrub, so to speak, that's a dwarf that smells like that, is pretty fun. And then the other plant I have are rhodohypoxes. And it's almost like a grass, and it produces a star-shaped flower that can vary from white to red. And I think there's a kind of a whitish blue and pink. And that spreads like a grass. And when you look at it, it looks like it might be crabgrass growing. And it produces a really dense clump, but it stays really well-behaved in a clump. And the pots that I have it in, it doesn't seem to be spreading more than a little bit beyond where I planted. There's no smell to those flowers, but they are very attractive. And that grows really well. And I asked the gentleman that runs the nursery, you know, what would be good examples for companion plants? And that was one of his suggestions. And I would agree with that. I have it almost probably 2/3 of the pots I have it in. And then the alpine fern is another one, but that takes next to no sun. But it's really attractive. Let's see. And then you guys probably also have five-finger maidenhair, northern fern, where you live. Yeah, I use that too. And I love that plant. It's a real soft plant that looks good. And you can put that in with low to rye, and that, you know, wouldn't be a problem.
Wow, yeah, I guess a lot of options for, especially...
and bulbs.
Bulbs, yeah, sure.
And not tulips, but and not daffodils, but a lot of native irises, crocuses, and there's the various other small bulbs that grow well for companion plants.
I was just going to say, you have these in your indoor pots, or are these for outdoors?
These are all outdoor. However, I'm thinking about that. You know, when you're growing Vireas for the first time, you always kind of have it in the back of your mind that they're going to be dropping dead at the, you know, drop of a hat. And White Smith says I'm not worrying about it, but introducing another plant into the pot worries me a little bit. So I do have some pots indoors with bulbs in them, and they're coming up, and also anemone. And then when I go to repot this bigger one that I have, I'm thinking about putting some anemone in with it, see how that goes.
Yeah.
And you get it for free already. So if you kill it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So we've talked light, we've talked water, we've talked soil, we've talked fertilizer, we've talked companions. Yeah. So Vireas can be a little tricky. Do you have to deal with any, you know, especially in the eastern U.S., we talk about root rot disease all the time. Do you have any problems with pests or diseases in indoor culture?
No, but well, outdoors, there's lice bug in this environment.
Yeah.
We're up 15, 20 feet in the air. And so I've only noticed that a couple times, and I put a very tiny amount of bare tree and shrub on the plants once, I think 2 years ago, and I haven't seen them back. So I think that, you know, the elevation off the ground makes a big difference, but it's not an issue. Inside, you get these little gnats that I don't know how they get in. I guess they get in through the screen door. There's water, you know, and standing that I have a humidifier in there. It's a little water fountain. And so I've had to put HGH swimming pool chlorine, about 1/4 teaspoon in that about once a week, and that keeps them down. But when I didn't notice it, I was pretty upset about how many of those little gnats there were. So I just decided to dump the water out and let them die, because there wouldn't be anything for them to grow. And then when they were gone, I put the water back in the humidifier and put the swimming pool chlorine in. I haven't had trouble. But the other issues about indoor gardening are that it's not like they're odorless. You have to be aware that if you keep the door shut in your room, it's not going to smell delightful in there. It's going to smell like the nursery. And so I tend to keep the door cracked a little bit, you know, to the patio, just to get some fresh air in there. And I mean, it's not a big deal, but it's not that cold. Like, it's probably 45 or 50 right now. But if it's 20 below, that'd be a big deal. Now, there are some downsides to it, or you could have an exhaust fan running in the bathroom or something.
Well, so the plants in their pots may cause smells sometimes, but you also have some fragrant Vireas, huh, that you can grow?
Yes. In fact, I made it a specific point to buy 3 white Vireas from Van Veen, all of which White Cloud Nursery indicates have tremendous odors. And so I'm just waiting for those bigger.
Are there any plants that you would recommend for a novice, someone who wants to try indoor rhododendron culture for the first time?
The varieties that Van Veen is selling at that size would probably be ideal. I think it would be a lot less plant shock. 2 of the plants that Shirley Bertelman sent me last November, second day air, arrived 2 weeks later. And I just shook my head. I thought they're going to be dead. And I opened them up and they were both blooming.
And Shirley's in Hawaii, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the surprising thing about that isn't that they were still alive and blooming. It was that the Eastern Pastel came through it with flying colors and is probably the best plant I have. I I'm telling you, I take that home to mom. It's that good. The other one is Avalon, which was the Beret of the Year in 2008 or 7 or something. Took a licking, and half of its main growth kind of wilted and had to cut it off. And so now it's starting to grow again pretty vigorously, but I think it's going to be a while before I see flowers out of that plant. That's the only one I haven't seen flowers on, actually. Yeah, if you're asking me what I would get, I think I'd start with something small and compact and nurse it along, because I think that once they get established to your situation, you know, where you're going to keep them, they'll probably do well. And that's a lot of like other rhododendrons, you know. PJM, they may say it only takes 25 Fahrenheit below zero, but I think it would take 40 if you lived in the right place and got it planted early enough.
Yeah, and if you left it outside and it got some snow around it, I think it could take,
Yeah, so I think it's the same thing with Beret's, that once they get acclimated to what you're putting them through, they'll do okay.
Yeah, we do some work with evergreen azaleas that are not cold hardy outside here at all, but we just, one of our seasonal employees who's returned year after year, and we just give him our leftovers. He takes them home to his house, puts them outside in the summer. They're really great. And then just throws them in his garage for the winter. No problems. It doesn't get too cold in the garage, but it gets a little cold, and then just pulls them right back out and they're fine. It's pretty amazing how many of these things you can grow just in a pot.
The plants I have outside, I don't think there's any transpiration or very little transpiration going on, because I water them every 2 weeks, but we went away to Tucson a little over 2 weeks ago and didn't water them. When I got back, it was still wet and they don't get rained on. So I think I could stretch it out to every 3 weeks. The watering, I can see how you could put a plant in the garage and let it sit there for a long time, you know, and not have to worry about it. But once
it comes out. It's like that. I don't know how often they do it, but it's this in this part of the world, all the nurseries, we have so many wholesale nurseries around us, and they just take their pot greenhouses, put a layer of white plastic over the top of the poly house that they're growing in and shut it up. And then I think they just kind of don't worry about them for a few months. And it's pretty amazing.
Humidity indoors is another issue. And, you know, I took White Smith's warning, you know, not to let them be exposed to low humidity, because it doesn't do well. And when you take cold air where it's like 50% humidity outside and 40 degrees and you heat it up, that drops the humidity probably by half or more. So if I cannot maintain the humidity in my room with, or I have the Vireas with my humidifier, I run a hot shower and get the humidity in the entire bedroom bathroom area up to 70%, and then shut the door, and it stays that way, you know, for quite a while. But that, I think, like in North Dakota, where it gets super cold or low humidity at below zero, it'd be really difficult on those plants, being in North Dakota, for instance.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. In my limited experience with Vireas, buying them and then killing them, but I put them outside and they grow well. And then I was like, okay, well, I want to grow them inside. And so I brought them inside very quickly, and it just got very dry very fast for them, and they quickly succumbed. I think it might have been possible to do it inside, but I should have tried to transition them a little more slowly, I think.
Yeah, you have to control the environment.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be nice if I could just bring them in and forget them. You know, I've got, in my living room here behind me, I've got a big tropical, or all begonias, I guess, are tropical, but this one is huge with big leaves with black streaks through it. And I have it under a simple grow light in my window, and it's growing like crazy. And the African violet's the same way. And you don't have to water any of that stuff very, very frequently. So I think that with the Vireas, it, light temperature and humidity, you know, I mean, everybody knows when to water. If it feels dry, you give it water. But if you have those other three things under control, if I do well, and having a resource is really important. You know, I'm so fortunate to be able to call the people that I do call, and I know they're be anxious to talk to me about it. I feel very lucky that way.
You know, Don, it's really interesting to hear all this discussion on Vireas or Vireas. I was introduced to those plants a long, long time ago as Malaysians. And I have an article that explains, you know, the history of how the terminology evolved. And we'll post it, you know, along with the podcast as one of the sources. But my father grew these Malaysians indoors on a balcony in a two-story house. and it was overlooking the lower floor, and above was a skylight. And I never was interested at that time, you know, in what he was growing, but he had quite a collection of these Malaysians and all colors, you know, white, pink, I think there were yellows.
Nice.
And they were always treated as something very, very special. Well, now I understand, you know, just how special they were. That's long in the past now. We no longer have them. But I've just found this conversation very, very fascinating and useful.
You know, I really enjoy it. I was really concerned when I had to move out of my house in my last garden that, you know, I was doomed. And I thought, nuts, I'm going to populate my deck, and I'm not sure my family members are all excited about that, but I am. And as soon as the plants, the big plants, get up so they're not running into them when they walk out on the deck, it's going to be tremendous. I get comments from people that are walking by below telling me how it looks great.
I'm sure it's a great asset to the condo.
Yeah. Well, that's another subject, because the condominium has some giant rhododendrons that they let their landscapers take head shears to. And it drives me insane when they do that. I end up going down to some of these big plants and climbing into the plant, and sitting on the branches and looking up and saying, oh my Lord, they really destroyed this thing. And
You should invite them up and say, no, this is how you grow a rhododendron.
Yeah, I just have to tell them to keep their shears off of it.
Oh, dear.
Okay. I want to thank White Smith for helping me as much as he has, because I have to say that without his help, I wouldn't be able to deal with it. And he's not a young man by any means. I think he's 85, but he's always willing to talk. And I think anybody who wanted to call him, he'd be glad to talk to him about it. So. He's great.
That's great. We should put his phone number up on the website.
Right. He did the Varea vine for years, and that's quite a volume of work. You know, when you look at it, I've read some of that, and that's just amazing.
That's the newsletter for the Hawaii chapter?
No. Is that what that is? He was at the time working at the Species Foundation.
Oh, okay.
And he put that together with them. And I think it's still all online.
But we can always contact you for his connection.
Sure.
That's great. Well, I'll have to get an
Easter pastel.
Easter pastel, right. That's like on the top of my list now for Vireos to try to acquire.
Yeah, man, that's tremendous. You know, I'm telling you, I'd kiss Cheryl on the lips for that one. He really sent me a great plant. I like it better than any of the plants I got out on the deck.
Yeah. I'm sure you've given Connor a lot of ideas.
Yeah. Excellent. You know, I mean, you guys are in an environment that you'd be forced to keep the Vireas indoors, I think, most of the time. I mean, if you had to keep it indoors 9 months of the year, you might as well leave it indoors all the time.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and the lights that I have aren't expensive. They're like $35 each, and I have three of them. Have a big plastic tray underneath all of them, which was, I think, $32 each.
Okay.
And so I don't get water on my bedroom floor, and or debris of any kind. And it's easy after that. You just get up and say goodbye. I'll be back later. And you go to bed, and there they are.
Yeah, and I just moved into a house, so now I have like legitimate space to put things in.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, Connor, I'm excited that you're a young man doing this. There's been an awful lot of people in my age group who've sort of passed away recently.
I know. I just saw Barry Starling pass this morning. A lot of like really important, really invested folks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so people like you, Connor.
I think you should talk to White Smith.
Okay.
And he'll tell you a lot.
Okay.
You know.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I'm trying to take it all in, trying to learn as much as I can. It's
he's a wealth of knowledge. Well, anyway, I'm glad that young people are getting into this.
Yeah, and that's the hope with this podcast too, is to try to get.
What do you do when you're not doing rhododendrons?
I don't know. I adopted a dog recently. I go to the movies a lot. I think the good thing. So my job is rhododendrons. So it's.
And that, well, say that again.
My job is rhododendrons. So
oh,
I'm the,
really? What do you
I'm
do?
The rhododendron curator at Holden Arboretum. And
oh,
I,
nice.
Yeah, and I'm I continue the leech rhododendron breeding program. So I'm doing rhododendrons 40 hours a week, and then then after rhododendrons, outside of work, I can do other plants. So it's a good balance. I can do I can do the other plants in my free time.
You probably enjoyed that database.
Yeah, it's I mean we have so many plants. It's so
pretty voluminous. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I was actually just working on some of our database this afternoon, just trying to plug new things into it. We just with the rhododendron breeding program, it's just like new plants every spring, and so you got to like plug the new ones in and make sure you're keeping all the data for them and just keeping them on your mind. It's, I mean, we must have made 20 selections this spring, and so it's like each plant, like you got to make sure you know what it is, so they could be potentially become a introduction, or there's something about it that's important that you could use for further breeding, and you know, don't want to lose track of these things because it takes 5 years for one to flower.
Is Fortuni hardy?
Fortuni is plant hardy, not bud hardy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I had one of those in Virginia, and it was hardy until some sort of boring weevil drilled a hole right through the main stem, and it just fell over.
Yeah, we have some Fortunis that are like 20 feet tall, and this past spring, an old black cherry fell on top of three Canadian hemlocks that fell on top of the black on top of the Fortunis, and it didn't crush them, but they lost their tops. They're these really sad looking Fortunis, but they're still alive. We're trying to nurse them back to health, but it's one of the taller rhododendrons that we can grow, so it's nice when you have really tall ones.
So seriously, one of the favorite things I have is just looking at the trunks of large rhodies.
Yeah.
You know, like the loderi.
Yeah.
The loderis, when they get big at the Crystal Springs Rhododendron Garden here, there's five plants that must be 60 years old.
Wow.
And the trunks on those things are about 5 or 6 inches in diameter. And there's like five trunks coming out of the main root.
Wow.
So I love those. I'll send you an email. I have that on my phone. This is a desktop.
Yeah, that would be really cool to see, especially because out east, they're few and far between to see rhododendrons that big and that old. So just have in our garden, we're really lucky because we have the David Leech collection, which started, he moved to Ohio in 1970, but he started working with rhododendrons in the 40s. And so he moved his plants from... before he lived in Ohio, he lived in Pennsylvania, and so he moved plants from Pennsylvania to Ohio. So we have plants from the 50s and the 60s that were David's in Pennsylvania that are now on the ground, still alive here.
Well, there must be some good examples of some of the Blue Ridge natives growing there.
We don't have a ton. We have some, and David loves using Catalgla, if you know Catalgla, which is a white-flowered Catawbiense. And so we have that, and we have like the Red Max. We have David's selection of the Red Max that are pretty old and nice. Really the nicest, biggest rhododendrons that we have, some of them anyway, are some of the Bosley-Dexter hybrids. So Charles Dexter, he sent plants to everyone. But there was a nursery here in Mentor, Ohio, that got a lot of plants from Dexter. And so we have, I mean, they're 25 feet tall, and it's just like cascading flowers.
Cool.
Yeah, they're really
that's spectacular.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's in this like very like intimate like path. Yeah. So it's like lepidotes on one side, and then these really tall Fortuni hybrids on the other side. It's really cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah, thanks a lot for sharing all your knowledge, Don. It's been incredible learning about Vireas, or learning how to save Vireas, and the whole story with them and growing them inside is sounds like a real, it can be challenging, but it seems like incredibly worth it. And so it was great to hear your experiences and just learn your whole rhododendron story. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And you know, it's gotten to the point now where I've got very few things that I can do in life, and one of them is gardening on my deck, and I'm taking every advantage of it while I got it.
And you're doing it so well.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for sharing it.
Yep, yes. You bet. Thank you for talking.
Thanks,
we'll
Tom.
See you again.
Yep, bye.
Curious to learn more about the topics discussed in this episode? Visit our website at www.rhododendron.org. Here you'll find tons of rhododendron resources, including tutorials, blogs, events, databases, and more. Click on the podcast link on the homepage to find more episodes, suggest a topic for a future episode, and get in-depth information about the people, places, and plants featured here. Until next time, keep carrying that torch for rhododendron, and don't forget to talk endlessly about this podcast to all your friends and family.